By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge that you are well aware of the foul language we'll be using on this show. So abandon all hope, ye who enter here.
That's definitely the short version.
Welcome, everybody, to Spawnometer. I'm your host, Mr. Fixit. With me today is...
Diablo Frank.
And as always, Frank has decided me to torture me with more spawn goodness. So let's get to that yum-yum-num of spawndom.
This is kind of a rough patch, folks. Sorry about that. So Spawn number 7 was released on January the 20th, 1993, per Mike's Amazing World of Comics. It included a pull-out Spawnmobile poster, so the toys are already raring up by this point.
I did not realize it.
The only other Image comic to ship that month was Pit number 1. This story is Payback Part 2. Which is dedicated to Rob Liefeld, who is at least the co-creator of Overkill. I would argue that he's pretty much the creator, based on the video where we see the character being designed, depending on how much of that's fake available. Out. Well, I mean, the whole video is kind of staged, but I don't know how much of it's premeditated and how much of it was impromptu.
Did they show how Stan came up with the name, or that the name was already just
Stan basically comes up with the whole premise, like, listen, guys, we're going to create a character together, and I'm going to tell you the name, and you're going to take it from there, and then I'm going to take all the credit, which would be funny if he weren't like...
True.
Yeah, it's sort of like if Harvey Weinstein makes like a sexual harassment joke. It's like, yeah, but you're Harvey Weinstein. You've done this shit a lot throughout your career. Stanley claiming way more credit than he actually deserves. Oh, I came up with the name. I co-created the character. You came up with a name. They created the character. So what happens is we watch Rob Liefeld draw 98% of the character. We see Todd McFarlane
add some chains.
Snark back and forth with Stanley, basically pushing back against Stan's assertion that, oh yes, I created it. This is my co-creation. And Todd's like, no, you suck, Stan, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're basically picking on each other, and Todd's doodling shit in the margins, and Liefeld's doing all the actual work. So at this same point in time, Rob Liefeld's Extreme Studios had also released 7 individual comic books. Of course, that number encompassed 3 titles and 4 different creative teams. You want to tell us what happened in Spawn 7?
If I remember correctly, Spawn had just battled Overt Kill. Overt Kill went back to the mob boss to tell him that the battle was done. Wait, or is this the one where he goes and he gets the weapons?
Spawn teleports into a military base to steal high-grade weapons.
I read 6 and 7 together, so they're kind of blurring together.
And you were wanting to talk last time about the teleportation technique.
Well, yeah. So it was like a little sperm shot.
It looks like throwing uncooked meat at a wall is his teleportation technique.
But it takes part of his, it takes away some of his spawn power. And so he's trying not to use it as much.
Yeah, that, and it apparently weakens him and makes him throw up and stuff.
Yeah. And so,
which I guess is a way of explaining why he doesn't teleport everywhere.
He has all these big ass guns. He's in the alleyway.
Very classic 90s armament. Like ridiculous, insane Tex Avery.
Very cable-ish guns. If you ever read any X Factor, he battles Overkill, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He starts basically blasting the shit up.
There's a lot of prolonging though, because before that they had a rematch. We're reintroduced to Tony Twist, who in the revised Spawn stories, the digital versions and reprints, is now called Don Vito Gravano, nicknamed Dracula. We see a lot of Spawn paddling around with the homeless people. We see him having a flashback that gives us a clue of who his killer might be. He basically sees a talking skeleton with a gun, calling him a bro. So
they do talk a little bit about Wanda and her flashbacks, right? Like she's
having dreams about Spawn and what he's going through now, and relating
how she's married to his best friend, and she has her daughter.
Yeah, and she starts to investigate that white dude that showed up looking for dogs.
Yeah,
and visits a veterinarian.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
They
part.
Drop an H. Ross Perot reference because the vet actually looks like the kooky, big-eared presidential candidate of the 90s.
I didn't realize it.
In pursuit of getting Payback Part 2 against Overt Kill, Spawn visits the former Tony Twist, now Dracula, to get information on where Overkill lives. And in order to do that, he blows great big ridiculous Tex Avery holes in the wall. So this whole thing is like a Looney Tunes. And then Spawn gets back to fighting Overkill using his weapons.
And just blasting the shit out of him.
They like meet on the docks. They blow up an entire dock.
There's like 4 or 5 panels of them just like battling, and Spawn is blasting parts of him off to the point where there's just an exoframe of him, isn't it?
Endoskeleton, I would say.
Well, yeah, there's not nothing left. His head is hanging on.
It's like his head's blown to pieces, and he's kind of
flopping. Did he put a grenade in his eye or some shit?
I think some shit like that. I mean, he appeared to completely destroy Overkill before the end of the issue.
To nothing. That's all I remember of that one. Like I said, this one was the worst.
That's all it was, really.
Yeah, this was the worst one of the two, because this one was just like, I remember the Wanda
nothing
shit.
To it.
No. And the last part of the book is just all panels of them battling with no dialogue, and then...
lots of spreads and shit, too.
What was the last lines where he's in the alleyway, isn't he? I don't
remember. Yeah, I don't even remember at this point, yeah.
Let's just chalk it up to this was primarily written to fill in for what we're kind of... Well, I'm kind of looking forward to the writer's block.
Right. We've both been looking forward to that.
Where
yeah.
each writer would get a take at the books. So this was purely filler, put some money in his pocket.
Some use out of Overkill.
Yeah.
Overkill, whatever.
Oh, that's bad.
They referred to as the Class of 86, or they referred to themselves as such, all the Image guys. Most of them were roughly around the same age and had a lot of the same influences. And you see that here. Last episode, we were talking about Wildcats. And Wildcats featured Spartan, a character who downloads his consciousness from one android body to another. This issue makes it appear as though Todd McFarlane used up Overkill in this first appearance by killing him off and blowing him to pieces. I believe later on it's revealed that Overkill can also move his consciousness to another robot body. Die Hard can transfer his android consciousness to another robot body. Why are there so much of these? And do you have any idea why that would be?
I have no idea.
I have an answer for you. All these fuckers clearly read the revamped version of the Thunder Agents that was very briefly a big deal in the mid-80s. And I don't know if you remember this, but what happened was John Carbonaro had bought the rights to the Thunder Agents from somebody who represented Tower Comics. Do you have any familiarity with the Thunder Agents?
No, but I'm sure you're going to frank the shit out of me.
Well, you read the DC version, right? That Nick Spencer wrote?
A long time ago, but yeah. I remember going with you to a shop one time and you bought a trade. You bought like a big book on it.
Yeah, the Thunder Agents were basically an early version of Image. It was Tower Comics. A superstar creator of the day, Wally Wood, decided or was approached to launch a new line of superhero comics during the Batmania phase. And he decided that one of the best ways to attract eyes would be to do a sci-spy riff, basically kind of James Bond superheroes. So he's basically combining the camp and the fun and the quippiness of Marvel and 60s Batman with James Bond and the Man from U.N.C.L.E., that kind of thing. So Thunder Agents is T-H-U-N-D-E-R, and that's an acronym for something that doesn't really matter. So Wally Wood had created this whole line of books. They weren't terribly successful. There was a lot of things that they did that the market really couldn't sustain. And so the line basically dried up within a couple of years' time. But there's some really great books. And then, of course, Wally Wood took his life in the early 80s. After he was gone, and obviously he didn't have any creator rights because those were held by Tower. Tower was a book publisher that dabbled with superheroes, but it obviously didn't take off. And so apparently this guy named John Carbonaro, who I know at one point was a taxi driver, lives here in Houston, met him one time. In fact, he came into the shop with a fellow who was doing some inking work with him that I still see at cons here in town. Carbonaro got these rights, and there was a lot of dispute about what rights he actually got. And part of the problem is that in a move similar to what happened with Night of the Living Dead and George A. Romero, when Tower put out the early issues of Thunder Agents, they failed to put correct copyright notices. Mm-hmm. So by law, the copyrights to a bunch of the Thunder Agents concepts and characters entered the public domain immediately upon publication. Having an awareness of this and having worked with Carbonaro to set up rights and to set up publishing in the early 80s, I should say, was being published by Archie, their little subline, the Red Circle books. But David Sinker, being aware of that copyright issue, started his own line of stories featuring the same characters. Because he had some money or some investors, he actually went out and got top talent. George Perez, Keith Giffen, Dave Cockrum, Steve Ditko, Jerry Ordway, Pat Broderick, just a fucking ton of very popular creators. But obviously, foremost being George Perez, who did covers, he did posters, and he did a feature on the character Raven. But the one that's important to this little sub-conversation is No Man. And No Man's gimmick, somewhat similar visually to both versions of the Vision that was owned by Marvel Comics. He is an android who was created by an old scientist who was trying to transfer his consciousness into an android body, which had blue skin. And he'd also gotten a hold of one of the creations of another scientist that gave him the power of invisibility. He would act as an agent for this organization, Thunder, and when his android body would be destroyed, he'd transfer his consciousness to another one of his android bodies and go to reclaim the unique invisibility cloak that he wore. But otherwise, he could just transfer his consciousness from body to body. So this was a big thing in the mid-80s. The book sold reasonably well. I think it cost $1.75 and like 85, so it was kind of expensive, but it was on that nice Baxter stock with his top talent. So you know all the Image guys were reading that. So all the Image guys were exposed to No Man, and apparently they liked that concept so much that they all were ripping it off. That's the grandpappy. If this one thing that would would seem like a unique concept because you didn't encounter it much at other companies, but yeah. It's rampant over Image because they're all the children of no man, I think. What did you think of this? Well, it was a terrible issue. What did you think of the cover?
Blends in with the rest of them. I can't tell them apart. You could show me the covers without numbers, and I couldn't tell you which is which.
It struck me that it's Spawn on a Punisher cover because everything about the cover looks like something you'd have in any of the period Punisher material. And of course, McFarlane was one of the few guys related to Image who really didn't have a lot to do with the Punisher at any point in time. So it seemed like he was getting his Punisher oats sown at this point in time. But it just so happened that Spawn was the one holding the guns. Not a huge fan of the cover, but at least that's a cover I can remember and I can peg what that story was, where a lot of the later Spawn covers are so generic, so indistinct.
Well, there's several of them that come to mind. I mean, the first cover, the one with Angel Wings.
Oh, that was years later, too.
He's fighting like a gang. They're like overwhelming him.
I think it's the Frank Miller one, right?
I think so, yeah.
So some of the earlier ones stand out more because they at least reflect story elements, even though I think it's, for the period, a generic cover. But for Spawn, that's the one where he has all the guns. That must be the second part of the overt kill story. So it was all right, but I'm not a huge fan of it.
About 20 years back, when I was creating characters like Cable and Deadpool and X-Force, I went off and created a new company with my partners called Image Comics. And those comics were some of the best-selling and most successful comics of their age and their period. Among them was a book called Brigade. And Brigade was a huge favorite with fans.
I also worked on a book called Brigade, which was pretty big for Image Comics.
I went and just had a solo studio, and there was a 16-year-old kid that I had met at a comic convention, much the way you're meeting people here. And I saw a lot of promise in this kid, and I asked him if he would like to be my assistant a couple days a week, and that's turned into a 20-plus-year career for him in comics. And I'd like you to welcome up the artist of Brigade and Deadpool Corps, Marat Michaels. Come on up.
Brigade number 1 was released on August 14th, 1992. It tied with Shadowhawk for the fifth Image Comics title, but was the first spinoff and the first comic drawn by a non-Image founder. Also, at the time of its release, I declared Brigade number 1 to be the worst comic I'd ever read.
Who? You?
Yeah. At the time I bought Brigade number 1, I decided that was the worst comic book I'd ever read.
You never got the troll.
Included in the comics were bound-in trading cards, and in number 2, there was a coupon for Image Comics number 0, which was a send-away comic. Mm-hmm. They were basically ripping off Valiant. They had their Magnus Comic Fighter.
Yeah,
number 0. So you could send off for it. I collected all those books. I think I even clipped the coupons, but I was terrible at follow through, especially with anything involved with mail order, so I never got my copy of Image number 0. I think I had a copy at the shop back when we had the shop. They also were a pioneer with a bonus book. I don't know if you remember that DC used to have like bonus books where you'd buy a comic book and then in the center or somewhere in the comic they would have an additional comic book story that was like almost like a complete comic book unto itself that was a promotional tool. If I remember correctly, the first of these was either in Shadowhawk number 2 or 3 or Brigade number 2, and it was called Extra Image Presents. It didn't last very long. Brigade was a bi-monthly book between the first and second issues. There was a 4-month gap to issue 3 and a 5-month gap to issue number 4. Number 4 was also a flip book with Youngblood number 5, which completed the proposed 3-issue miniseries at another publisher with a largely different creative team. The credits on the Brigade miniseries were Rob Liefeld as creator, co-plotter, and Marat Michaels as penciler, co-plot. What they did on the inside front covers of Brigade is they'd have the Image eye, and so the dot of the eye would be Rob Liefeld, Marat Michaels, and then the shaft of the eye would be everybody else. So it just goes to show you Rob Liefeld, whose contributions to 2 of the issues was a cover and was the creator of the characters, gets top billing. He was a plotter, right?
Yeah.
And then Marat Michaels, the penciler, is sharing that, and then all the writers, all the inkers, everybody else
underneath them.
Yeah, so whether it was intentional,
a bit of a slap in the face.
Yeah, it's a fucking slap in the face. Among those talents included scripts by Rob Liefeld, Hank Cannells, and Eric Stevenson. Cannells was slowly phased out, and Eric Stevenson took over more of the book as it progressed. Inks were by a fellow named Paul Scott, who I don't recall going further into the career, and then Norm Ratman also did a lot of inks, and Ratman's a guy who's done a lot of work over the years. I think he's one of the better inkers in comics, and certainly a big find for Image Comics. And I've met him. He's a good guy. He inked a piece for me. Color design was by Brian Murray, which I think was actually one of the best things about the miniseries. Most of the extreme stuff, I thought Brian Murray did some some really excellent color work on them. Kurt Hathaway was the letterer. He was the guy who took over lettering on Youngblood when it went from horrible to passing. Still not great, but at least it was okay. The book started at Malibu Comics. Like I said, it ended up at the Pure Image. And throughout the Brigade miniseries, there were no dedications to anybody. The story starts in Malibu, California, with Battlestone running around naked except for like bike shorts and sneakers. And he's, you know, running on the beach working out. There's a beach house where Brigade lives, and two of the members are fighting with each other, and that's how the book opens. You end up getting these little data files on the individual characters featuring narration from an unknown character at this point in time. So we revealed that Battlestone is a superhumanly strong and vulnerable badass fighter. He's a major asshole. He's the former leader of Youngblood and the founder of this new team of vigilantes called Brigade. He has gray hair with braided pigtails.
He has
and
a skull, right?
Yeah, he's got the little skull jewelry on his forehead. Reminded me of the clasp of Warlock's cape from back in the 70s. And he has a gray uniform with a bunch of metal accents at the crotch, Colossus metal sheets. Then the next character is Seahawk. He's the co-financier of the team along with his brother. He's also a superhumanly strong, non-vulnerable badass fighter, but he flies. He's also a major asshole, and in fact is almost indistinguishable from Battlestone in personality, except he's the one who gets yelled at by Battlestone. And he's a blonde dude with a ponytail mullet.
I think I remember him.
Yeah, and he's the one who has the silver mask with big points, where he's like a Batman Wolverine type hybrid.
Yeah, got blue, white, right? Or his colors?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Then you've got Cold Snap. He's the other brother. He has ice generation powers. He's sort of the Able to Seahawk's Kane, but they're both violent toward each other over dumb teenage bullshit. Cold Snap is a bit less of an asshole, and he looks like Booster Gold, except with a blue and white instead of a yellow and blue costume. He has average length blonde hair with a preppy haircut. You've got Thermal, who has powers of fire generation and manipulation. She's a blonde chick. She's got a yellow costume with a fire crotch shooting up the middle of it. And she's possibly a schemer because we catch part of a telephone conversation that she's having on one page in the first issue, and then we never hear anything else about that again. You've got Atlas, who's a growing guy. He's only a minor asshole. He's got brown hair with woolly sideburns and a vague accent. I'm thinking maybe he's an Aussie. They never clarify that, and it's not going to be relevant in the long term. He has a red and blue costume with a domino mask. He's Colossal Boy from the Legion of Superheroes. I didn't reference Thermal or Cold Snap because those are such generic superhero powers that there's no real avatar of those.
Yeah.
Then you've got KO. He's a marksman and a martial artist. He's a short, mild-mannered Asian with jaundiced complexion. He's got sickly yellow skin color, and there's a lot of skin showing in his costume. It's sort of a basically just a black leotard with a bunch of brown leather accents, and he's got one of those fucking weird 90s head guard things where we were talking with Mac about it, that it's like a sort of a beret. I think the whole purpose of the things were just like to keep your hair out of your face. That one that it would encircle your face,
yeah,
and that's all it would do. He's got one of those. Finally, you have Stasis. She's a blonde chick in a skimpy green costume that's only introduced halfway through the first issue at the start of a battle. She's got the game-breaking power to negate kinetic energy to freeze everything in place. So in order to make up for that, she's got the catastrophic drawbacks of it never seeming to work on any of the characters they fight, and she's always the first team member to get laid out. She has no discernible personality whatsoever. In the first issue, there's a short, balding dude with white lamb chops who appears to be Oberon from Justice League International, but they never identify him. He only appears in a couple of panels. He only says one line, and then he's never heard from again in the miniseries. The issue starts where terrorists having taken over the Maruko Tower in Washington, D.C., which is supposed to be Youngblood's stomping ground, but since Youngblood is in East Berlin dealing with Prophet and the Disciples, they're not available to deal with the situation. Both teams are out. Brigade flies from Malibu to Washington, D.C., even though it makes more sense to me for a Maruko Tower to be on the West Coast, but whatever. So we're introduced to Lieutenant Lewis Harding, who apparently works with the D.C. police, but in the Youngblood stuff I've read and in the Brigade stuff I've read, this guy never turns him again, so I don't know why they bothered to name him. It's a black dude. Kind of looks like Al Simmons as drawn by Todd McFarlane. We're also introduced to the reporter Diane Jimenez, who looks African-American but clearly must be Latino or mixed. She's a reporter in Washington, D.C., but she's going to turn up again in issue number 2 back in Malibu. So this whole thing about making a trip to Washington, D.C. seems ill-advised, a way for them to reference Youngblood.
Mm-hmm.
Brigade goes and fights these terrorist guys who look like Recorder from the old Hercules comics, but they're humans. They got human faces. And so Brigade wipes these guys out very easily and shows off their powers. And then for some reason, one of them runs away. Battlestone goes and tackles this dude, and they have a moment in the stairwell that's very reminiscent of Die Hard in a place that's got a tin name very similar to, what's the name of the towers?
Takanawa, was it?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. I can remember it earlier, but I can't remember it now because I'm just having issues with recall this evening.
Yeah, that's a wild goose chase over here at Nakatomi Plaza.
It's revealed you didn't find a bomb because I am the bomb. And at the center of his chest, the bomb, which he then triggers. And so So somehow the entire Brigade team has gone from being inside the building in a level above Battlestone to being outside the building at a safe distance. So when the bomb goes off, the entire building collapses and they're just watching it like it's something that's happening off in the distance. Oh my God, Battlestone's dead. There's no way he could have escaped that, even though they all escaped and are far away, blocks away a moment later. And then the issue ends with a two-page spread of Battlestone walking away unscathed from the destruction. He didn't even say anything.
Wow, that sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
No thought process went into writing the story.
So then the second issue, we find out that the guy who's been narrating those data dumps is a fellow named Genocide. He's a blue, bulky, but also chubby-looking alien. His head looks like Gargoyax from the Doom Patrol, but then his body's cut. He's got a lot of blue skin showing, but he also has red and yellow thigh-high boots and briefs and shit. And it's actually cool-looking because he looks like a Superman-type guy. That color scheme is, of course, very iconic for superheroes. But the dude's name is Genocide, and he shows up on Earth. He specifically targets Brigade because he's looking for a good fight, and he's just on Earth to blow shit up and have a good fight. So he's been studying the Brigade team. Despite clearly knowing their secret identities, where they live, what their powers are, he then travels to LA and starts trashing shit waiting for them to show up. He knows where they're at, so it doesn't make any damn sense, but it's an opportunity to show a bunch of rubble. And so they all have a big fight for the entire second issue, and then everybody gets teleported to a spaceship where it turns out the Genocide is the crown prince of some alien royal family who has been running off without telling anybody what he was up to. They've decided to not only bring him back home where he belongs, but to take Brigade with them because they've committed the crime of having laid hands on their prince. Mm-hmm. So they're all going to have to be executed for that.
Okay.
Also, it introduces a subplot where a black dude in a suit named Mr. Khan, who works for the government, visits a white dude who's an older guy who's balding, who also works for the government, who is a friendly with Battlestone and has been working with the Youngblood organization. Mr. Khan's like, we're shutting Brigade down. These guys need to go down. It's your job to bring these guys down. Mr. Spicer is like, oh man, I should have quit when Battlestone quit. I hate being in this position, but I guess we're going to have to bring Brigade down. And then they don't mention that at all in issue 3, and then it comes up again in issue number 4. So we're on issue number 3 now, and it's the Imperial High Council, who are the Shi'ar, we'll say. There's a Lord Magistrate dude who's blued with white hair, and he looks like one of the Zentradi from his Robotech, but he's got Doctor Strange's cloak wrapped around his midsection as though it were like a loinclothy sort of thing. He's the one who pronounces they all have to die, and keeps calling all of them Taraban, so apparently that's like the generic name they have for anybody from Earth. Because Brigade has no interest in their death sentence, they fight a bunch of guys, and then they tunnel their way into the sewer system on this alien vessel world, whatever it is. They're not super clear about it. They're running around in the sewers, acknowledging that they're in an alien sewer. I don't know when it became a cliche for people to run around in the sewers. I guess because at least sewers are big enough for you to run around in, unlike vents that can fit entire human bodies that don't exist in the real world. But nobody would ever want to run around in a sewer, especially an alien sewer. And wouldn't you get all kinds of fucked up diseases from doing that?
Again, you're putting way more thought into a book that it feels like they wrote on a napkin.
I don't think it got writ. Just maybe talked about some shit and the guy just started drawing fight it. Scenes.
Yeah, I could almost agree with that.
While they're in the sewer, they run across an alien xenomorph that's very similar to the alien that was in Shadowhawk for that one issue, the Liquefier.
Okay.
And this alien is powerful enough that he can actually scratch Battlestone, which is supposed to be impossible. In one moment, it ejaculates a white substance into Thermal's face and knocks her out. But because all we see is the white substance and Thermal getting hit in the face by it, we don't know where it comes from. We don't know what it is. Yeah. I don't know if he spit venom at her, if it was fucking whipped cream.
Jizzed.
Look at the blood!
It only happens at one time, one panel. Nothing is established
this
correctly.
This book sounds fucking nuts.
So the way they finally defeat this alien is Cold Snap freezes it solid with as much cold as he can project at it so that Battlestone could then punch the ice and explode the alien. But the problem is they never show the alien encased in ice. They just explain what happens in the dialogue. So you just see Battlestone smashing ice and no more alien. So the Magistrate dude kept referencing this team called the Factor. And it turns out that the Factor are basically three members of the Imperial Guard from the Shi'ar. I'm not going to name them. I'm not going to tell you their powers. It doesn't fucking matter because they're not around long enough. These guys proceed to kick the asses of all of Brigade. The Magistrate has decided that he's going to not have the death sentence. Instead, he has use for Brigade. They're too powerful. He's going to find a use for them. And the Factor's like, I don't think that the Lord Magistrate's thinking clearly. I don't think this is a good thing. Maybe we just tell him in the heat of battle we were a bit overzealous and we killed all these fuckers after they'd already beaten them. And Battlestone's still conscious, like, either kill us or shut up about it. Which is the worst fucking tough guy line, because your team is has already gotten beat by these dudes, and they're about to murder you.
I wouldn't even call them
Brigade.
It sounds more like punching bag, because they seem to be getting their ass beat quite a bit.
Then this team called the Birds of Prey show up. I don't know if you want to call them the Silverhawks, or they're a bunch of Thanagarians, or what, but they're hawk guys, who are apparently the natural enemies of the magistrate dudes, and run those guys off, because they're like, oh, there's like six to our three, we're going to run away. And then they're like, what are we going to do with you assholes? And Brigade's like, fuck you, you're not going to do anything, because we're badasses, even though you just saw us get our asses kicked. And so even though they're doing nothing but giving these guys attitude, they end up doing a team up to invade the capital city to do some damage and to steal a spaceship so they can get the fuck out of there. Genocide tries to have Battlestone engage him in one-on-one combat so that if Battlestone beats Genocide, then the Brigade is free. And if he loses, the Brigade team becomes slaves to the Empire. And Battlestone's like, fuck you, I don't accept your terms. Fight, 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 fight. And then somehow the rest of the Brigade team get involved in it as well. Things are just about to resolve, and then a stray misfire from Genocide strikes Alice in the chest, and he dies instantly in a pool of Bloodzone blood. That's why it doesn't matter what accent he had, because he's dead by the end of the fucking issue, which is too bad, because he's actually one of the more interesting looking characters in this generic ass fucking group. Brigade steals their ship and flies through the hangar just as the doors are about to close on them, fly back to Earth, the end, except that at the very end, Mr. Khan's like, if Brigade shows back up again, I'm going to send Bloodstrike to kill the lot of them. I made a point of reading through the letters column of Brigade, because this is obviously a terrible fucking book. And as much as I'm trying to go back and look at Image through rose colored glasses, Brigade was so terrible, I didn't even make you read it because there was no point in it.
Yeah,
it was such a simple, stupid story. I don't think that it's the worst comic book. It wasn't even the worst comic book I'd ever read at that point in time. I think it was the worst new comic book that I'd paid full elevated price for compared to regular comics. They were $2 when the regular comics were like $1.25. And so I was really pissed off about how much money I was wasting on it. Obviously, I hated the story. Brigade did have a key role in souring me to Image Comics as a whole because I hated the issues so much. Awful team of characters, bunch of jerks, no other personality besides being jerky to one another. But what's funny is you read the letters columns and it's nothing but fucking praise. And there's only two explanations for that. Explanation number one is the only people who care enough about Brigade to write a letter to them to be published were people who liked Brigade, or they were just full of shit and they were publishing nothing but the positive letters. And that makes the more sense. There's already a letter in the miniseries referencing solicitations that were months in advance because the book was so fucking late that showed the entire Brigade team getting killed by Bloodstrike as part of the initial story of their book. And so we were like, wait, are you going to kill everybody? And I haven't read those issues, but if I remember correctly, they kind of sort of killed or broke at least the team pretty badly under Bloodstrike. Bloodstrike, they've been promoting this team ever since the early Youngblood issues. So it felt almost like Brigade was getting built up just to get killed off by Bloodstrike. And it reminded me a lot of the Ultraverse publishing initiative that was born out of the success of Image Comics, because Malibu made so much money just distributing Image Comics that they were able to form the Ultraverse line full of major push with TV ads featuring tons of established talent. And one of the books they came out with that line was Exiles. Did you ever read Exiles?
No. The original Exiles? Yeah, with Juggernaut.
No, but the original version, though, when it first launched. I think the book was drawn by Paul Pelletier in one of his first assignments after he'd done some X-Mutant stuff. But it's this whole team of characters that are very X-Men-like, and it felt like that was going to be the Ultraverse's X-Men. But where all the other Ultraverse titles were being written by veteran talent from the Bronze Age of comics, this one was guys who were actually publishers at Malibu who weren't known for writing. They were known as like editors and publishers there. And so there was a big controversy because they came out with four issues of Exiles, and then they solicited another like two or three. And it turns out the book was always going to be canceled with issue number four, because it was always planned to be a miniseries where the miniseries would end with the entire Exiles team being killed to launch a crossover event, Breakthrough, George Perez was doing work on. And so retailers were super pissed off because they tied up capital in ordering books that the company always knew were never going to come out, because the company had always intended to avoid spoilers, to avoid anything getting leaked out, that they were actually going to kill this team as a way of promoting the big crossover. And it feels to me like Image was doing the same thing. Maybe they had an inkling that people really hated these characters and they were a bunch of generic assholes, and there's so little thought seemingly placed in these characters, even though they date all the way back. Most of them were from the original Youngblood. You see them pictured on that cover that Jerry Ordway inked that was going to be the cover of the Youngblood special that was going to come out in 87. So these were some of Liefeld's oldest characters, and yet they wiped the fuckers out or redesigned them going into the next volume of this book. And of course, they were heavily promoting the entire team getting killed off, and with the books being so delayed, they spoiled themselves, basically. Yeah. Born to Die to some degree. But also, they just feel like a bunch of characters from a role-playing game. It feels like a Champions campaign that they adapted into a comic book, but there was so little thought put into this. And it's funny because the whole push for Image Comics was creator-owned comics. And then here's a spinoff book where the only creator of the characters only plots the book and draws a couple of covers for them. And the first Brigade cover is super fucking uninspired. It looks like a convention sketch where Liefeld doesn't even bother to draw like the lower half of Battlestone. Mm. It's just a pinup shot of Battlestone clone with nothing but cross-hatching covering the bottom half of his body and some bullshit like smoke around him. And then headshots of the other team members. There's a bunch of pinups inside the books. Most of them were drawn by Marat Michaels, as I recall, if not all of them. And they were all would have been better covers than the one they were actually using. Did you ever read Brigade back in the day?
I think I read a couple issues. It almost sounded like a money grab now.
It definitely felt like a stopgap measure between issues of Youngblood.
I think I only like the first two issues and that's it. And yeah. I never read any more of that.
And I think Marat Michaels had been an assistant to Liefeld for years, and this was his opportunity to actually do a book.
So I hired first guy actually, well, Marat Michaels, who does Brigade, has been with me for years. He used to assist me. I draw my pages real small, tiny on the page, and have them blown up on the copy machine and then transferred, and then I do the finishes. So he was kind of that in-between step. He'd take my drawings and do the copying, blow it up on the copy machine, transfer. So he was kind of an assistant to me, did some background.
Marat, let me tell you what a comics assistant does. You pay him mainly to listen to you talk all day long, and occasionally he goes to the Xerox place. I mean, he was like my Robin and I was Batman, and we had our Batcaves. But
talk about runs.
And FedEx, we did FedEx runs that rival every cop pursuit you've ever seen. It was like, we have 10 minutes to get 20 minutes away. Let's go! Anyway, great stories, but Marat was there when Deadpool was created, when New Mutants 98 happened, when, hey Marat, I'm thinking of leaving and going and doing my own thing, and I think it's going to be called Image. Hey Marat, what was the first job you worked on again as assistant in New Mutants 92? What was going on in that book? Is that like the Extinction Angels?
No, it was right before the Extinction Angels. Okay. It was Cable versus Wolverine.
Okay, Cable. So, yeah, Marat would come down, and we would just talk comics and bounce ideas off each other, and I knew Marat wanted to draw comics, and he had his own samples. And like I said, when Image Comics was born, you know, when Youngblood was launched, you can go back, and there wasn't a lot of blood in anything, like something blood. And so I announced Youngblood. And Youngblood sold a million copies. Very fortunate. Thank you. That wasn't the plan. It was just, I got to do my own thing. I had already been on New Mutants for almost 3 years, so I decided, I'm going to try and do this. And like Tim said, they're like, we don't want you guys hanging out anymore. I actually did a Wizard cover that had Shaft from Youngblood with Cable, and they almost sued the Wizard for running it. So things went sour bad. But then they got, Marvel and I, we're on and off. We're like, we break up and get back together every couple years. With the time that we were doing Image and X-Force was ending and I did Youngblood, well, suddenly Youngblood's a hit, and Marvel and DC both that summer, Youngblood comes out late March, immediately 30 days later, Marvel's summer annual event, which is 20 books, is called, I think, New Blood, it's original, and DC is called Blood Ties. And I sat back, literally, you gotta understand, I'm 23 years old, and I'm cracking myself up. I'm like, they want to bury me. This happens, people. This is not me making this up. This happens. And so Blood Ties and New Blood were coming out. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta get all my characters out now because they're gonna crush me. So my comic, this company may only be out for 4 months. Cut to 20 years later, Richard. But and so I said, Marat, I've gotta do a second book. Can you draw it? And
I said yes.
and guys, then Brigade sold a million copies. And again, you just sitting back going, it was a great time. All of you were on board, and we just thank you so much.
I'm sure the expectation was he would come out on a more regular schedule than Liefeld's books did, and said they were both just really fucking late, piled on to the charges of extreme lateness that Extreme Studios were facing and Image as a whole were facing. In rereading the story, it's still pretty fucking bad, but it was a trashy but amusing. The art quality was super fucking inconsistent. They had tons of fucking inkers. You could tell that despite the book taking months and months to get done, it still looked rushed, not ready for prime time. I've gotten numerous commissions from Marat Michaels in recent years. He's a really good guy. I like him a lot. I like his work a lot. I love the pieces that he's done for me. He's a much better artist now than he was back then. So I feel bad for slagging on the book. But Brigade really is everything that was wrong with Image Comics in a nutshell.
Okay.
Any thoughts?
No. I mean, dude, I read them two issues back when they first came out. Like everything you told me, I'm just taking at face value because I do not remember one bit. I could remember what some of the characters look like, but that's about it, dude. So no, I'm good. Something I never have to worry about.
I just have to say, you were really having a run at Wildcats. I thought about pointing out some really heavy-duty critical stuff with Wildcats, but A, you piled onto them so hard, I didn't want to add to that. But also, having read Wildcats and then read Brigade, Wildcats was so much better than Brigade, so much more of a fully realized concept, so much better drawn, so much better colored. Even though I liked Brian Murray's coloring, it was one of the best things about it, but everything about Wildcats was so much better than Brigade. Even if you just argue that it was competent and just in line with the lesser years of X-Men in that time period, it's still so much better than Brigade and so much closer to the mark as far as being competitive product against the major companies because it's comparable to some of their best-selling works that it's hard for me to slag on Wildcats. I think the premise is so much better and so much better explained. Where Brigade, there's just nothing there. I don't know who these guys are. I don't know why they're vigilantes. I don't know why Battlestone has put this team together. I don't know what his deal is. I don't know why he's the former leader of Youngblood. I don't know what connection he has to that team. And you get no supporting characters. You get no development whatsoever. You don't get any fucking background. You get fucking nothing. So Wildcats is so much better than Brigade. So much more of a fully realized concept. So much more professional caliber. It's so much of a standard bearer. It was so much better than a lot of the stuff that Image was putting out. However much you disliked Wildcats, you would have fucking lost your mind if you had to read Brigade. Despite some issues with Brandon Choi's scripts and the difficulty that the book seemed to have getting traction early on in their stories. But compared to Brigade, it's a masterpiece. And I don't know that Murat Michael, since he doesn't get any kind of creator credit, I don't know how well he did working on Brigade, which I'm sure sold a lot of fucking copies. I'm sure he was well compensated, but I don't know that he benefited, obviously, because Brigade wouldn't have done anything without it being connected to Rob Liefeld. But I do get the feeling that Brandon Choi probably did a lot better as a person who was in the ground floor at Image Comics than Hank Cannells or Murat Michaels ended up getting to do. So I have to applaud Wildcats for that. We're getting some bad shit. It really does look like a Champions comic book. I think it was Eclipse used to adapt Champions campaigns and NPC characters into comic book stories that looked totally fucking Hydrox comics. So that pretty much covers this episode. So what I'll do, though, is I want to read some material from the Image Comics introductory interview from Wizard Magazine number 9, where he actually talks about the character, so we can see how much of the shit that I said he said he actually said. Spawn will be written, inked, and penciled by me. Lettering will be by Tom Orzechowski of X-Men. Dale Keown will do a pinup in issue number 1, and it'll be a character of his own creation, which he'll own the copyrights to, and that was Pitt. Hopefully we'll have Dale on board down the line and maybe expanding on his character. I'll also have George Perez do a 1-page pinup of Spawn, and he'll be penciling and inking it himself. That was a great pinup, that, by the way. I love that George Perez piece from the first Spawn, or one of the early Spawns, anyway. And in the center of the book, we'll be giving away a free poster that I'll be doing the black and white to, and Ken Stacy will be doing the airbrushing for. It'll be a pullout. Man, I miss those Ken Stacy colors from the early covers. How long did the Spawn poster, the centerfold poster, last?
I wonder if it like died off. 5 issues.
God, that's a lot longer than that.
Did it?
I think it lasted a few years into the series.
I don't remember the posters that often.
Talking a little bit about Spawn, I'd rather not go into that much detail, but what I can say right now is that he was originally killed in 1987, and he's been shot back to what he thinks is the day after he was killed. But by cruel fate, he's back 5 years later, and where he was originally a black man, when he comes back, he's a white man. And the big thing about Spawn is that he is a combination of the guy with no superhero powers, like Batman, all the way to guys like Superman. He's going to play it as straight as he can as a human being, but he has the power literally to move a planet. He won't do that, however, because every time he uses any kind of power, it brings him closer to death. He's the kind of superhero who can and will die someday. He's got a finite amount of power, and that's it. Hint, Spawnometer.
Ta-da.
The one thing that bugged me is that Superman can play ping pong with the planets, and he can use his power at any time. This guy doesn't. He has a finite amount, so he can either use it in one day, or he can stretch it out for 40 years. And then Larson literally asks, is there like a little meter somewhere so he can read it? And Pauline says, he doesn't know. It bugs me that superheroes use their powers on a lark all the time. So I guess Larson coined the Spawn meter. McFarlane continues, but he has to be more responsible in using his power than that. He's like spending money. You've only got $100 and it has to last you for the rest of your life. He's going to try and get through using pennies at a time. To give you an example, if he gets in a barroom brawl and 40 guys come after him, he knows he could let the shit get kicked out of them, and he might do that because a beating isn't that big a deal because he doesn't want to use that power. Every time he uses the power, he comes closer to death, and he's got to make the decision. Is it worth it for me to win this time to use my powers? Another option is he's got 40 guys around him, and one guy steps forward and he French fries that guy to powder. Then he crosses his fingers because the energy it takes to French fry the guy is the equivalent of wiping out 8 of these guys. It's a bluff at this point that the other 39 guys will gulp and step back. If they step forward, he wouldn't use any more power at that point and would take the shit kicking. It's going to confuse the kids why sometimes he hails a taxi to get across the street and other times he can fly through steel. It depends on how far he is pushed. There will be a symbolic meter in all the books to show the kids how much he uses and how much he has left. I base a lot of stuff on my life. If I was to get killed today, I would want to come back for one reason. I love my wife. I don't want to come back to exact revenge on people. So this would be the first character in recent memory that comes back for love, not for hate. He wants to come back to see his wife, but unfortunately in the deal he gets screwed because he's not dealing with someone upstairs. He's dealing with someone downstairs. He makes a deal with the devil that says, okay, I'll send you back. I'll give you a finite amount of power, and once it's done, you're mine. You are going upstairs, but the deal now is I get you, but you get to see your wife during the time it takes you to use your power. But he thinks he's going back the day after he died, and he comes back 5 years later. It's now 5 years later, and he's a white man when he was a black man. His wife's remarried, got kids, and stuff like that. The reason he came back is now taken away from him. Hopefully we can pull it off and make him a tragic character. I'm trying to tie it into one of these Youngblood guys, since he was a government worker. But he just got pissed off at the system. When he comes back now, he comes back with a new identity, and he can now do some of the things he thinks are right. McFarlane once again asserts, we're monthly people. And McFarlane sort of kind of was, but not the rest of these dudes. Everybody here has 6 to 10 characters as backups, and I could give you a list of 10 characters. If Spawn doesn't work, then I would be foolish to continue it. So what some of the guys are doing is they put out a Wildcats for 3 issues, and if it doesn't quite go, there are another 10 characters you can draw from. So why not try another one, and then when one hits, then maybe come out with the monthly of that one. I don't think it's a sin to try out some marketing stuff. To put out a monthly, you're sticking your neck out a little bit more. I think sometimes it's good to put out characters, and if the kids don't like them, we'll come up with something else they like. I don't think Jim or anyone here is cheating the public. They're getting one good book right now out of Jim, and Jim is going to come back with another good book. It's just not going to have the same logo on it, I'm sorry to say. You can't let the readers dictate everything to you. You have to do what's best for you. If I stay on Spider-Man for the next 20 years, the energy wouldn't still be there. I could still do it. On a lark, I could do it, but it wouldn't be my best stuff. The companies have now become character-driven, and everyone in this room would agree with that. The characters are far more important than the creators, and unfortunately, the comic book companies have stopped acknowledging that human beings created those characters. What we're doing now at Marvel and DC is creating characters that they're going to use against fellow creators. This is where my moral stance is. Even though I was somewhat successful, I never created anything new because I would not allow any company, I don't care what company, to use my creations against a kid who is 3 years old today, 20 years down the line. When I was raised, my dad said that if you get an apple unexpectedly and it turns gold after the guy gives it to you, you make sure he gets a piece back because you don't know when you took it, it was going to turn to gold. The comic book companies took those characters not knowing they were going to make them tens of millions, and now they know that they make tens of millions. They're not willing to acknowledge the guys who created them. So what we've got to do is seize the moment. If I was to do this 3 or 4 years ago, I would bring 20,000 people, and that's tough to get people excited about it. If I can bring potentially 500,000 now, the chances are 50 times higher that a reader will stick around. The pressure is now on Mark Silvestri to sell his book. So now if his book doesn't sell, he can't say, I got a bad anchor or a bad editor. He's got to look at himself in the mirror and say, you screwed up and you didn't get the right people and you're not doing the right character. I have 2 choices. If I don't want to get weighed down by continuity, then I just stay away from everybody's stuff. Then I just draw my stuff. Some guys are really tied into continuity, and that's good because then we can do crossovers. Again, we can make all the decisions, good, bad, or indifferent. None of us will be forced to work on crossovers or projects where we don't want to use our characters, unlike some companies where it's done to generate higher sales. The goal I see, besides standing shoulder to shoulder, is to go beyond the direct sales market. If I just want to do direct sales comic books, I'll make a living for the rest of my life. X-Men comic books sold how many zillion copies, but I say X-Men to my mom, she doesn't even react to that. She's heard of the Hulk because it was on TV. So what I would like to see the company do is expand to the mass market. That means doing licensing deals or getting into places that don't usually have comic books. If I want to do something aimed at military people, it's tough for me to go to Marvel and put an ad in a military paper and put an ad at the military bases because that becomes a separate entity that they have to deal with. But if one guy with Image wants to do that, he knows military stuff and he wants to sell it specifically to the military, boom, there are ways to go about that. I just think that there are too many open doors right now that nobody has tried to walk through, and we can uncrack a few of those in a few years. We didn't get to see a lot of that, but we did get to see some of that. We did
sounds like McFarlane was like the driving force.
He really does come across that way, yeah. And he is one of, if not the most successful of the founders.
Yeah, he's the engine, and the rest of them seem to be just behind him, kind of tagging along a little bit and seeing where he goes.
Yeah. There's a degree of burnout to anybody, but I think the burnout factor will be a lot slower because working for a company, you get nipped at the heels. The way I always say it is you do the 100-yard dash, and you're giving me army boots to run in. I'm still trying as hard as I can, but I'm not getting there as fast as I could if you gave me sneakers. As long as I don't have to answer to anybody, that may sound egotistical. I don't get into any fights. I got into a lot of fights when I was only a penciler with writers and inkers, but I take over all those things, and whether it was any better, I was mentally happier. It was like, wow, I like comic books again now. The burnout factor gets slower and slower when you are in charge of your own creation. Since we only have a finite amount of time, we have to go out and give some of the responsibility away. We have 3 people from Malibu Comics on board to help us take this thing into the 90s. The one thing I would like to make clear is that this is a creator-owned company that Malibu is helping with their expertise to get us past those humps and hurdles. And again, that only lasted for about a year or so, and everybody benefited from that, so it was a good deal.
That's for a Mac.
So one more thing that we got to get covered.
It's mail. It's all you, dude. Okay. It's all you.
It's time once again for Spawning Ground. I was super lazy the last time I recorded with Mr. Fix-It. I didn't bother looking at any of our levels. My microphone was way up. Mr. Fix-It's was at normal, and I just completely overwhelmed him sonically. Plus, my own audio was super distorted. So instead of inflicting that bad audio on you, I'm just going to cherry pick a few exchanges between me as Mr. Fix-It and just kind of burn through the mailbag. The pair of us had some pretty fun conversations. I think that it's probably best to just write those off and address them as they come up as points later on in other episodes. Our Facebook got visited by Mike Peacock, Joe Crawford, Derek William Crabb, Pat Sampson, Ali Batts, and Michelle Fife, with a Tumblr like from Zegas, the new graphic novel from Fantagraphics by Michelle Fife. Twitter affections came from 20th Century Geek, 108 Sage, Ali Batts, Biko Django, Bone Dragon Comic, Bones Cafe, Cap'n Flash, Cash Flag, Charlton Hero, Ed Moore Jr. at Indie Comics Fan, Marvel Bronze Age, Miskatonic, Teal Production, and Urban Fantasist, Fanholes Podcast, FKA Jason, Glenn Pappas, The Hammer Strikes, History of Comics on Film, Ignacio Rio, Illegal Machine, It's Plastic Man, James Wheeler, Jeffrey Brown, Joe Crawford, Jose Luis Guy Mijanos, Justice First Dawn, Kaiser Leo, Longbox Crusade, The Man on the Wall, Michelle Fife, Mike Ratliff, Norberto Brown, Odell Abner Dracula, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Sean Phillips, Sid Blizzard, Silver and Gold Podcasts, Siskoid, Son of Cthulhu, Starboy, Steve Sellers, Transform and Rollout, Trekker Talk, Warlord Worlds, Yartum, and Yo Ardes. Jeffy Brown asked, you going to talk about Wildcats? And offered a piece of Mark Silvestri art featuring the Wildcats. It was pretty awesome. The Man on the Wall wrote, long live the dark age of comics. Michelle Fife wrote, not to be confused with Wild Bratz. Wild Bratz was one of the dozens and dozens of Image Comics parodies. This time it was released by Fantagraphics, and the specific cover that Fife is referencing it was by Bill Willingham, of all people. And we'll likely address some of those in a future episode. Longbox Crusade wrote, I love the 80s song Wildcats by Duran Duran.
Wildcats! Never losing! Wildcats! Never chose this way! Wildcats! Never close your eyes! Wildcats! Always!
Wait. Maybe it's Wild Boys. Oh, well, Wildcats works too.
And I have to say, Wild Boys is definitely one of my favorite videos of the 1980s. Certainly one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Duran Duran video. You remember that one, right? The Mad Max riff?
Yeah.
With the fucking cool-ass animatronic head? You remember the bald head? There was an animatronic, and he's like, open his mouth, and they keep dunking Simon LeBond in the Proud Mary Steamboat deal-a-jiggy? Okay.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Remember that video?
It's some similarities there, but completely different songs. Same time period. Well, the one that always got me was Relax versus The Reflex.
Oh, yeah, that one I remember.
Relax, The Reflex.
Karaoke time at Image Comics.
And actually, I don't know if we covered this on the Wildcats episode or not, but the original name of the Wildcats was the Wild Boys. I believe that's what they were called back when Jim Lee and Brandon Choi were coming up with them back when they were in high school.
Okay.
Possibly around the same time that the Duran Duran song came out. They just decided to change the name once they put it into print.
you know, Wild Boys sounds a little
fire eyed,
but also possibly because X Factor debuted a team of villains called the Nasty Boys, and maybe there were some issues with that as well.
See, if you say Wild Boys, you really can't have a female character.
You could X Men.
You would look at the male character and say, "I guess you're the Wild Boys, and you are what, the Wild Girls?" Like, yeah, but Wildcats, you know, cats is kind of a plural form for male female.
Yeah, but I think it's an IP problem because whenever I try to search for Wildcats, I get the football team.
Well, I was gonna say I think of the Goldie Hawn movie,
which is also a football team.
Wildcats, they actually have their own song.
What is it? Better than diamond rings. Human beatbox. Wildcats. Wildcats.
See, I hate when you frighten me like that from the
side. Well, it was Wesley Snipes was in that too.
Yep.
And wasn't that like the guy from Nightmare on Elm Street 2 in that too?
Yeah. Wildcats.
Wildcats. I say they call me Jumaine, the ebony lover. I validate the theory when I'm under the cover.
It's the sport of kings. Better than diamond rings. Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Longbox Crusade writes, "I did not know that. Was just being cheeky. I'm a sucker for 80s music." Illegal Machine wrote, "I literally was singing this in my car this morning when it came out on the podcast. Very happy to see this tweet to confirm I'm not insane."
Yeah, I mocked the song, but it's extremely infectious. It's once you start hearing, yeah, it's they're heroes, not zeros. Yeah. Let's see.
Really made millions off of this.
Justice First Dawn wrote, "I flipped for this Wildcats and Youngblood crossover in the day. The two teams certainly put due diligence into appearing in other books." Jeffrey Brown wrote, "I'm enjoying this episode with the Wildcats talk. Could never get the action figures of Wildcats way back when. I still don't own any Spawn figures." Oh, and what about Savage Dragon figures from the 90s? Mr. Fixit owns a shitload of the Spawn figures, and I own a fair few myself. Mr. Fixit, did you ever get any of the Wildcats figures?
I used to have a Zealot. I think I had a Voodoo, I think I had. The only reason I got them was because I went to a shop with them and they were on liquidation for like a buck. And so they were still in a box. And I bought them in transit, moving around. I lost the box. I had two boxes full of toys. And shockingly, the one with the Spawn survived. The other box had Wildcat figures in there. And what else did I have in there? I just had all kinds of just random stuff that I would find at shops, you know, that was liquidated. Creed, one of the figures too I got. One box was full Spawn and the other box was just random figures I'd come by in contact and bought. I know in that box I lost my Max statue.
The only Wildcats figure I ever owned was Voodoo. And I know that because I still own her. She was actually up on the shelf the last time Shag visited as part of a little diorama with Shadowcat and some other characters. And I was also sorting my trading cards recently, and I have a 9 pocket page that's pretty much all Voodoo. I included the trading card that came with the action figure. But even though I was really into Wildcats for a while there, I never went back and bought toys. I just never caught them on sale, and I was never willing to pay a bunch of money for them. Plus, most of my favorite characters from Wildcats weren't really part of the original team.
I like some of the other ones, like Wetworks.
Majestic was Superman for sure, but with a suffered no fools approach. But Ladytron I still think is a cool as fuck character. A killer cyborg with a lot of attitude. Just the way Alan Moore had written her and how subsequent writers had fleshed out Ladytron.
You remember Ladytron? She was the punk rock cyborg that was a member of the Alan Moore. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She was fucking badass.
I hope Frank and Fixit get the chance to cover Stormwatch, Max, Wetworks, and Cyberforce. I've projected a schedule through to episode 30, which has Cyberforce penciled in for episode 9, Wetworks for episode 12, the Max for episode 17, and Stormwatch for episode 20. Musical notes, hey, back to Wildcats. These are like a few fave issues from my collection and offers issues 8 through 9 and 11. But I did chuckle a little when you made the stylistic similarities between John Lynch of the Wildstorm U and Ultimate Universe MCU Nick Fury. Once again, that's something I had never thought about before about Ultimate Nick Fury. Maybe Mark Miller and Brian Hitch liked it. Kaiser Leo wrote, Overkill was truly a throwaway villain. The design was truly basic and the chains were unnecessary. What bothered me the most were the small feet on his trunk-like legs. Jeffrey Brown wrote, I remember Overkill was done better in the HBO animated series of Spawn. I have this issue too. My only complaint about the cartoon is that I thought he should have an Italian accent since he's out of Sicily, right?
I think American, dude. He just worked for the family.
I just like the idea of him running around with a stereotypical accent.
Because then he sounds like fucking Super Mario.
You say that like it's a bad thing. He'd be like Wario. I'm gonna kill you, you Spawn. His design to me, looking at this issue now, is very over-designed. I like the green and silver colors going on. But looking at this, he was very much made to be created into an action figure. Zealot was totally Wonder Woman. She's like right up there with Topaz, Queen of Windor from the Ultraverse as Wonder Woman inspired characters.
I'm not sure I agree with that entirely. I think that the Coda are very much Amazons,
yes.
But I think that Zealot owes a lot more to Elektra and maybe some Red Sonja.
Wonder Woman. I can see her.
The heavy martial aspects, the swords, her weird relationship with dudes that's angry and violent. So I would say Zella owes more to Elektra specifically.
Number one, Wonder Woman uses swords.
Only recently,
she never
dude.
Really banged dudes.
She banged. You know, she was with Steve Trevor for years and years, though. Grifter is kind of like the Steve Trevor to her Wonder Woman. I will give you that.
Okay. They both come from mystical islands.
I'm saying that the specific character of Zealot, because of her hard-edged attitude, her red costume, her use of swords, her very overtly violent activities, I think that's very much more in line with Elektra.
No, Elektra's not even close to it. Elektra was batshit crazy. Hearing voices and following the hand and...
But I think Red Sonja's in there too, though.
I see her as the opposite coin to Wonder Woman, where Wonder Woman is a diplomat and Zealot is more forceful. They both use swords. They're both first to charge to a battle. They both can take the lead. Anytime I've seen Elektra in a group, she's not a leader.
I don't see Zealot as a leader either. She's your Wolverine.
No, because there's times where they break up the group and she's running. Hell, in the book we read...
Zealot's a Wolverine. She's someone who can do a field command. She can lead people into battle, but she's not like an overall leader. Your type person. She can be like the team leader, I don't think.
I just see her as the opposite coin of Wonder Woman.
Spartan was the android Cyclops. Voodoo in the comics was interesting. Her cartoon counterpart reminds me of Jubilee.
I thought Kitty Pryde.
Well, I think it depends on what generation you grew up on. If you grew up on 90s X-Men, then Jubilee. If you grew up on 80s, then Kitty. Today, you might be like X-23.
Maul was the Hulk, and Warblade, I remember having a cool design. Like the working relationship between Void and Lord Imp, but I still think Void is another character I thought had a cool design.
I know, Imp and Void just kind of had a unique dynamic. I could see where you could maybe draw parallels between Puck and Vindicator from Alpha Flight. To some degree, but obviously Void was a much more cosmic character.
Is that a hype joke?
It's like you got a chick who's got energy powers and a skin tight costume that covers everything but her mouth, and a little person who's more gregarious. They're the two closest members of that team. It's the same similar dynamic in that respect, but I think that they're so different from those two characters because Jacob Marlowe is not a physical combatant at all.
To me, Void, if anything, she's gonna be like Gateway. That's all she is. It's like she teleports.
Absolutely. She's kind of like the Vision, too, to some degree. The robot.
For informational and get us point A, point B.
Well, she has some energy blasting and shit, too, though, doesn't she?
She really doesn't fight, though. She's like...
Not too much.
Like, Void, get us there, and then she faints for some reason. Because, like, oh, the temporal warp or some bullshit just happened, and I'm passing out for the next 20 minutes. Imp.
Overpowered for her team, so they have to negate her as much as possible.
Yeah, I just always saw him as the financier, and that was it.
I got into the Wildstorm U books after this with Stormwatch and Gen 13. I had the first four issues of Wildcats. I'm pretty proud of this. As a kid, I had seen the cartoons, and that got me interested in it. It reminded me of X-Men. Ironically, looking at this now, yeah, it did does, but with aliens. Griffin reminded me of Gambit and Wolverine.
By special permission of the United Nations General Assembly, you are listening to the Higher United Nations Defense Enforcement Reserves Context and Synthesis Transmission, or as we call it, Thundercast. I'm Bill Zanowitz.
I'm Rob Steger.
And this podcast is all about the Thunder Agents. Who are the Thunder Agents, you may ask? Well, the Thunder Agents were a team of superheroes that initially appeared in the 1960s, and the concept was super spies meet superheroes. Sounds cool, doesn't it? They were originally published in the 1960s by a now-defunct publisher known as Tower Comics. I'm Bill Zanowitz, and I've been reading comics since 1973, mentioned in the past on a podcast that I co-host, which is the Comic Book Bears. If you are familiar with gay culture at all, bears are hairy, heavy homos, and what our show is a group of three hairy, heavy homos who read about comics and talk to you about them, but I swear to you, you don't have to be a hairy, heavy homo to listen in, and I have had a lot of familiarity with Thunder Agents. I first read the various series that appeared in the mid-80s and just as quickly disappeared. And over time, I've read most of the stories, not all, but I definitely have them all.
My name's Rob Steger, and I have been reading comics since 1977 or so. I've read a ton of comic books, but I am really, really curious about Thunder Agents because I've read one of them. I have read the first issue, and I am holding off. I'm reading each one for each episode, and I'm going to experience the suspense of these issues as they go on.
There's a lot of treasures ahead of you, and a lot of not-so-treasures. Luckily, this is a series that is fairly easy to accumulate the entirety of.
Yeah, you can find most of them at in-stock trades for half price.
Go out there and buy some Thunder Agents.
take the Earth's mightiest heroes, each an invincible champion of justice, and band them together to assemble the legendary Justice League of America. For 261 issues and 3 annuals, the DC Universe was defended from threats on Earth and beyond by this legendary team. Operating from a cave in Happy Harbor to a satellite orbiting 22,300 miles above the Earth to Detroit, Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast, will follow the league through all their evolutions. Please join your host, Mike Peacock, as I seek to cover all of the issues of the classic pre-crisis Justice League of America series. Through the magic of the JLA transporter, each issue will be randomized, with special episodes covering a complete story arc if needed. Along with the issue coverage, we shall also look at what the then-current members of the Justice League were up to in solo appearances in other comics for the JLA cover month issue. So do not hesitate to activate your JLA signal device for Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast on classicjla.podbean.com or by subscribing through iTunes.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!